The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg coming to you from the motherland, Texas, where we are desperately trying not to melt now. This is the Brothers Wiss number 138. We have a couple of faces somewhat familiar, I think. I can't remember. Chad, have you been on before? I think you have, haven't you?
I've been on once, yeah.
Okay. Chad, where are you out of?
I'm out of Golden, Colorado, home of Coors Brewing.
I thought it was pronounced Kurz.
Curry.
Give me a Kurz. That's how we hear it down here anyway.
I see.
We also have, let me see if I say it right, Colin Zapalak.
That is correct.
Oh, man, look at me. See, I can get one name right. Out of all the hundreds of names I've read, I get one right. And that makes up for everything. Where are you out of, Colin?
Just south of Fort Worth.
All right. Fort Worth couldn't hold them. Good times. All right. Let's do the quick stuff. We don't have any patrons this go around, but we do still have our tried and true sponsors. So Colin has volunteered to read one of them. So I'll start, and then Colin, you go, and then I'll close it out. So I'll start with Sonar. Brought to you by Sonar, a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP and operational support system. You can visit those guys, see what they're all about, if you go to sonar.software. All right, Colin, you're up.
All right, so next is QuickBit, which is an indoor-outdoor 60 gigahertz kit that's just set it and forget it simple. They have a crazy feature set for the price with API deployment tools, solid distance, and up to 8 clients per hub. And I actually got a chance to see these guys over at the Wisp of Spring show here in Dallas. And they were actually a lot smaller than I thought they would be. And they're very well built, all aluminum. So I was very impressed with them when I got to sit down and talk with them. Mm.
Sizes and everything, Colin. It's how you use it. And those guys are at QuickBit, QuickBit.com. So the last one we have on the docket today is Tower Coverage. TowerCoverage.com is how you're going to find those guys. And Tower Coverage is your RF propagation system to empower your network. Real-time data metrics enable your coverage area, reaching your customer base, and more. The industry's best RF propagation mapping system allows website integration for customer sign-up and pre-qualification. Use this data to scientifically plan network expansion and help your WISP succeed. Get a free trial today at TowerCoverage.com. Excellent. All right, so most of what is on the docket for today was fleshed out by these two fine gentlemen. I kind of phoned it in and added a couple of things really quick, just for funsies. So it looks like from the list, most of it is nice, long, conversation-based stuff. So I thought we would get some of the quick stuff out of the way first. What do you think, guys?
Sure.
Start with the quickest and then move on to the conversation. So MikroTik put out their newsletter number 100, lucky 100, I guess. I taking a look at it, it's not really blowing my skirt up. It seems like most of the stuff's already been announced, right? There's, what was it, number 3 they were talking about is SwitchOS for the CRS-354. I don't know anybody that's, you know, celebrating over that, but, you know, that's the thing that's out there. The MLAG, that's already something that we've kind of talked about, I guess. You know, it's been kind of out in the wild for a minute. Layer 3 hardware offload. We've already talked about that. Another implementation of 802.11 AC, Wi-Fi 5, Wave 2. I think people are still waiting on Wi-Fi 6 from a MikroTik product. Listen to me pooping on them. Was there anything in this that you guys, like, it grabbed a hold of you? I see there's some more stuff about the knot. Maybe that calls to one of you guys?
Well, the knot a little bit. And then when on their page announcing they're doing product news in Spanish now, they have two new devices, which I remember watching this when it first came out in Spanish without subtitles. And I think those, if I remember correctly, those are maybe the next-gen 60 gig product that they're showing off there in that picture.
Oh, like what kind of next gen? Is that Terragraph next gen or just their next gen of the current stuff?
You know, I had heard 802.11, AY thrown around a bit, but
which is Terragraph.
Yeah, but you know, we haven't seen anything other than this. And at the time when I watched it, I was sitting to pick up my kids in school, so I'm just sitting there on YouTube and on my phone in my car, and just, you know, trying really hard to concentrate because while I understand some Spanish, I don't speak any, and and so it was really a challenge for me.
Mm. Well, that'd be an interesting announcement if that's what they're going to make. We're all waiting on Microtik and Ubiquiti, right, to come out with Terragraph, because they're the guys that are half the price of everybody else, and so you can buy twice as much of this stuff.
Mm. What I'm really waiting for is, I heard a rumor from a little bird that Giannis Magus is going to be doing one of these videos soon, and I can't wait for the memes. So I'm just going to sit here twiddling my thumbs like Mr. Burns, just kind of waiting patiently.
Excellent.
All right, so let's see, what else do we have on the list? Colin, you did some edge switch upgrades, right? Some automation there. You even were kind enough to make a blog post about it, which will be linked in the show notes here. But I thought that was pretty cool. You picked up and ran with Ansible. It looks like you got it pretty fleshed out. You said you were still doing a little bit of tweaking and tuning here and there, though, right?
Yes, here and there. I thought I had it done yesterday, and then I ran it and ended up taking three sites down. Because you know what runs fine in my little lab here at the house of three or four edge switches. It scaled up largely for the most part, but I think the big problems were, A, I was doing my copy protocol over TFTP at the time, since it was all inside of our management LAN, and it didn't like the UDP packets, and I guess some of the switches just completely rejected the new image and dumped it. So when the script proceeded on to change the boot image to the backup, it was some like ancient image, and I think we found 1.1 and 1.2 versions of the Edge Switch OS, which are 5-6 years old now and don't support a lot of things. So it pretty much bricked a couple of those sites. And so I wrote in a failsoft in the version that I have posted right now that actually says, hey, you know this running image right now? We're going to copy that to the backup just in case. You know, that way if we do have that issue, at least we're running on the same exact image that we're running on.
That's cool. So. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty clever. I also like how you put your timeout as 420. Little nod there. Your favorite time of day?
I didn't even think about it, actually. I was just trying to convert minutes. It's like, well, how long does it usually take versus...
Sure.
It's like, oh, 420.
Freudian slip, is that what you call that?
Yeah. Well, I was just in Colorado last week, so...
Yeah, you've been world traveling, haven't you? You've been all over the place.
Yeah, in the last 2 weeks, I've been up to Illinois and Missouri and came home, and then we went to Colorado, and I guess right after, I'm here mostly. I've got to run around the state a couple of times in the next couple of weeks, but I'm here, and then I've got to, after the 4th, I've got to go into Cancun, and then after I get back from Cancun, I'm actually, I've got to go to Florida. So
Well, Cancun's of your own choice there, right? The rest of it's for work.
Yeah, the rest of it's for work. I didn't plan the trip. My wife and my mother-in-law planned the trip, so. But it'll be fun. We haven't gotten out, and we used to go on cruises, and that kind of stopped. Our last cruise was right at the beginning of 2020, so it just kind of stopped when all that happened. So, but since then, I've been pretty much work from home. So as long as I have internet, I can do my job.
Yeah. I mean, that's the boat I'm in. We haven't started traveling for work, although I believe here in the very near future, we are going to be able to start traveling for work, which ought to be actually kind of fun to get out and get moving, do my song and dance for humans instead of just black little squares on a Zoom meeting because nobody will turn their camera on. Savages, savages. So I try and always make sure to turn mine on just out of solidarity for those people talking. Having said that, I'm sure I've kind of like just dazed off into the distance multiple times because I kind of get distracted sometimes, but such is life. All right. Let's get into the meat. So we have some interesting subject matter here. Number one, it says, and I'm not sure who put this in here, but I'll let you speak up. It says active versus PON deployment. Why am I seeing so much active fiber being deployed? What am I missing? And I'm assuming what you, a lawnmower, hopefully you guys can't hear that too loud. What I'm assuming is, like, we were talking about fiber deployments, like out to people's places, you have PON, which is passive optical networking, or you have active, which is more like your active Ethernet, right? So active Ethernet would be like a SFP would go into a switch, and then you would just run that to something else that goes right into an SFP, and that's, you know, one-to-one, whereas PON is you're using prisms, and you're splitting it out, and you're doing like a TDM protocol, so it's many-to-one over kind of a single port coming off your aggregation kit. So who was that, and then what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that was me, and I will admit right off the bat that this is not an area of expertise, but we've been looking at going with a local grant to do a fiber deployment to about 300 mobile homes spread across a couple different parks. These are permanent mobile homes, and so I'm starting to look at, all right, well, what are we going to do? And I hate to do anything other than, you know, putting glass in the ground, because that seems a bit more future-proof, but some of the smaller... most of the smaller ISPs around us, at least in Colorado, when they do a fiber deployment, they're doing active glass versus PON. And I haven't gotten a real good answer as to why that is. And so I feel like I must be missing something there, that when I look at, you know, an active deployment, you take a neighborhood of 300 homes, which would not be all that unusual. That's going to be 200 strand, or at least 300 strands of glass if you're doing BiDi's, or 600 strands of glass if you're doing regular optics. And then you've got to have a switch port for every single one of those, which means you've got a lot of pedestals that need power, that need air conditioning, that potentially need heating, that need batteries. And I don't understand why more and more deployments are going active versus when I look at a PON, I could do a 300 home deployment potentially with, you know, four strands of glass and just split that a bunch of times and bring it all back to a single head end where I only need power and batteries and air conditioning at one place instead of switches spread throughout a neighborhood. But so many active deployments keep popping up around us that I feel like there's got to be more to this than my infant brain.
Well, I remember we actually did the QuickBit podcast. There was a fella from somewhere up north that was on there, and his name escapes me right now, but that's what he's doing. He's doing a lot of fiber deployment, and he does active Ethernet. And I remember him saying that nowadays, for the cost of just running, you know, a pair or an individual fiber to every one of the people versus doing the PON solution, it's really, to put that much glass in the ground, it's not that big a deal anymore, at least for him. Also, that means you're not having to deal with the prisms and amplification. And so I think a lot of us, too, we're more familiar with regular active Ethernet, right? Like, I've got one fiber going into an optic and it pops out somewhere else. And I can, just for me at least, my brain wraps around that so much easier than it does the other stuff. I think planning is probably easier, too, right? So with the PON network, every time you hit a splitter, right, that's going to separate out into multiple different residents, you're going to get some amount of loss associated with that, right? As well as you have to use, I think, terminators sometime at the end of your fibers. Otherwise, you might get reflection. Or you have to use, what is it, APC style fiber ends? Is that what it's called? Where they're cut on
The angled one. Is that's the APC?
Yeah, they're
right?
Like
the
cut angle on a slant, right? So it's a whole host of new technologies. Not that it's necessarily difficult to understand or anything like that. And I'm sure once you get some runtime with it, it's fine. But the active Ethernet for me is like so much easier for me to just, you know, it's like it makes sense to me. Like I've done it for so long. I could see myself picking up and moving with that, as well as like testing if I'm having problems. Also, I don't know, this may or may not make more sense, but, like with the PON solution, say you're doing, I don't know what, like a 64-to-1 or 32 or whatever it happens to be. If that one optic fails, you lose all those customers. Wherein if you're doing a 1-to-1 and you lose a single optic, you're just going to lose one customer. So I guess it could maybe be an advantage in that respect as well. I think, active Ethernet, would you assume that it's cheaper to do active Ethernet than it would be a PON solution. Like the CPE you're going to put at somebody's place, it seems like it would be cheaper on active than it would on PON. Am I just grasping at straws, or do you think that's correct?
I thought the CPE cost was pretty similar. That Ubiquiti one, which is the cheapest one, their CPE is, that ONT is real cheap. And then the, I think the Calyx, you're looking at maybe slightly more than a standard router that you're going to drop there. Like if you're going to do like an active with a MikroTik, like a HAP AC or something that's got an SFP cage in it, I don't know that PON is that much more expensive, but you're saving a lot on optics because you don't have nearly as many optics at the head end that you do with a PON. I get the fact that, yeah, I can wrap my head around active because that's what we've been doing all of our lives, and a passive network is just a little bit different beast. But when the big boys come in, you know, the CenturyLinks of the world and those guys, when they come in, they always do passive. They're never doing active networks in the residential area, at least. So that must mean that there's some scale there that benefits them for the residential side.
I think Tommy, on his new project, he's doing FiberStore switches. I don't know that I would necessarily go FiberStore. I'd probably go something else, like on the head end side. And then his CPEs, he's doing the G-Pin 21s. So I think those are like $40, yeah. And that's doing, you know, kind of his conversion there at the residence. So that's pretty inexpensive. I guess inside you'd still want to put, I mean, I guess not. Well, I guess it depends on your model. Do you want to put like a managed router in there? Was that an upgrade sell that you're doing for folks? And if you are you just going to terminate it out in the box and then bring it in and then have your, you know, your managed router inside? I'm assuming that's what most folks do. Does anybody actually carry the fiber all the way in? Everybody I've seen like actually terminated it outside. Does the conversion there?
Right. Yeah, other than that, G-Pen 21 is not waterproof, so you're going to have to put some kind of small enclosure and then mount that thing inside of it. But yeah, I don't know that you want your fiber at an area where your customer can monkey with it, because they're going to. You know, the moment the internet goes out, the next thing they're going to do is start undoing fiber connections, and now you got dust and
they got to roll a truck. Anytime anything's available. So I've got, at my MDU, I've got HAP AC squareds. In there acting like for every unit, it's got one sitting there. And of course, it's happened more than once. He's like, I unplugged the cable from the router and plugged it straight into my thing. It didn't work. It's like, it's designed not to. It's never going to work without my equipment on there. So it's, if it's there and available, they're going to poke around with it and prod it. So such is life. But so it makes more sense to keep that stuff outside. It seems like we're also more accustomed to running an Ethernet cable, you know, coax through somebody's wall as opposed to the fiber. So that might be a little bit easier as well. Although I have seen some solutions from, I think it was Corning, where they have this really thin indoor glass, and it's basically like a caulk gun of adhesive that's just almost invisible, and you just run the fiber like along the baseboard and it is invisible when it dries. So it's pretty gnarly watching them snake that around somebody's house, because as soon as it dries, it was like you didn't even know the fiber was there anymore.
Well, that's interesting. At least until that guy shows up to re-side the house or you know, do something to the moldings and now rips your fiber because he has no idea.
Yeah, or like there. Whenever they go in the house, it was like you'd run it along the baseboard and then like over door jams and stuff like. So it's pretty cool. But yeah, like if the vacuum cleaner hits it or something, I guess you're toast. So that would be bad. I don't know.
Yeah, I could see people cutting that out just because they're wondering why. One baseboard is caulked and the other one isn't.
Such is life. Yeah, I don't know. In my head, I think I would like active, maybe in a smaller deployment. But I guess if you're going all in, is the cost savings associated with PON, is that the way to go? Because I mean, that's why you would do it, right? Is it's cheaper, I would think.
Cheaper, but I also think it's like simplicity. I'm picturing the splice trays that are, you know, next to every other house. And if you're feeding a neighborhood that's got maybe 200 homes in a certain direction, now you've got 200 or 400 fibers going that direction. So your splice trays are gigantic versus a PON where you've got one or two and your splice trays are tiny and you're just repeating it. Like, I don't know, that's where I'm kind of getting stuck when my brain looks at the physical deployment of it is much easier with a PON than it is with active.
I don't know, because it's like you could just go a little ways and then you would dump off, you know, 50 or 60 strands, whatever it happens to be, and then just keep trucking on and then dump off. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think I would need to talk to some folks specifically about this piece and see what their thoughts are. I bet we could get him back on the cast and you can actually ask him those very specific questions. I'd be curious. And then, yeah, grab a few guys that have sort of done it one way or the other and just have a little round table on it. I'm curious too. Like, I honestly, I've talked to people who've done both ways and I've never really said, well, you know, why specifically this way versus the other, you know, or if I have, it's obviously fallen out of my head. I'm pretty bad about that.
Yeah, I think Mikey's done it both ways, if I'm not mistaken. I know he's got a pond out there, and I'm sure he's got some active as well. And so I was hoping he was on here and would put his two cents in for that.
Yeah, well, I've also got to say that you guys were kind enough to join on a Thursday afternoon, which is well outside our normal window. So thank you guys very much for doing that, which is the reason Mikey wasn't able to join today. Man, I'm like stripping down. I'm having to take my socks and everything off. It's the afternoon, and this side of my house like faces the sun. And here in Texas, what did they tell us to like set our houses to 78 degrees or something?
78. Yeah,
it's bananas, dude. This is the hot side of the house too.
Well, you know,
you guys are having power problem 2.0 in Texas now.
That's what ERCOT's saying. But you know, it was kind of funny when I was coming home on Friday. You know, I got up and left West Cliff. It was you know, a balmy 54 degrees, and you know, got up and left, and you know, we got down to Amarillo, and it was 74. You know, nice. Drove 120 miles further to Lubbock, and it's 109. I'm like, what?
It's ridiculous. And then I think we've got a hurricane on the way that's gonna hit the coast on Friday. I guess tomorrow. Is that tomorrow? I think tomorrow. So we should get a whole bunch of rain again. It's rained like 20 days out of the last 24 or something. It's bonkers. Anyway, speaking of the heat, somebody says it's getting hot. How are we protecting our gear from the heat? Routers hitting 220 degrees Fahrenheit, freedom units, internal temperatures. So that's interesting. It's always been like this weird mixed bag for me with stuff outside, you know, because I'm always afraid to vent my enclosures too much because, you know, it's like, we'll have a couple of years where it's dry. Well, it hasn't been dry for a long time, but you know, really dry where it wouldn't be a problem. And then you know, it turns into a swamp like we have right now. It's how do you deal with venting your enclosures with the humidity, even environments where it's going to get crazy hot? What do you guys do for that?
You know, I dealt with this a little bit when I was working for Chevron and then, you know, doing the Motorola subcontracting thing. And it was, we were pretty much always using DDB enclosures with their Pentair AC systems when, you know, like the 1500 and 2000 BTU units. And in some cases, like now, you know, in the MDU space, we're putting mini splits in our MDFs just to try and keep them cool. So, you know, it's almost always some form of air conditioning. And I know exactly for like, we still kill a lot of switches and stuff, mainly because we're all beachfront stuff. So it's extremely humid and we're always killing ports. So, you know, it's not just the air conditioners, but the air conditioners certainly help prolong the life. And they're a lot nicer when you got to go in there and it's not 120 in there and you're just like, ah, it's nice. I think we even spec'd out one DDB enclosure that it was twice as big as we needed it. And we put a light on the inside. So when it's 105 outside, the technician opens the door, shuts the door behind him and sits down and works on the equipment inside the enclosure.
Yeah, we did an MDU. And at this one particular one, we had like kind of a little hut on the outside and it was like screwed to the wall and like sealed up really well. And what they did is they punched a hole into the closet of the resident and then put a little fan in between so that it with a little temperature probe. So if it got too hot in the enclosure, it would just suck air from the resident's unit into, you know, the kind of our little enclosure screwed to the outside and then vent out. And so that was pretty good because it was like positively pressurized. So it wasn't letting like humidity and stuff like that come in. It was always pushing it out constantly. And, you know, it was such a small draw there. I don't think it hurt their utility bill too terribly much. So that was pretty clever. I know in one unit, set of units too, we had window units in there, and that was great until, I don't know, it started for whatever reason, like every 6 months we would lose one and it would die. Only this particular model we got, it wouldn't stop blowing. It just started blowing like super heated air into there. So if you couldn't get to it fast enough, yeah, it was like nuking the switches. So
yeah,
most of our deployments, unfortunately, are mini pop. So we don't have, you know, they're not indoor. They're enclosures that are outdoor. I try to, when we can, mount them on the south side of the house, or the north side of the house, rather, so they're not facing the heat the entire time. But we did our rolled out Zabbix a couple of years ago, and we're really good about all the templates, making sure that the temperature triggers in there, you know, match the manufacturer specifications. So I thought, all right, well, this is good. And this summer, you log into Zabbix and it's just
everything's pink. Screaming.
Everything is alerting, you know, and it's not just the, we got a bunch of hex POEs and 4011s that are out there, and they're in enclosures that don't have fans in them. The air fibers are overheating. The dragon waves are hitting their upper temperatures. Like almost every single piece of equipment out there is hitting the upper limit of the manufacturer's specs. And it, maybe that's okay. maybe everyone else is experiencing this as well, but when we took the time to see, all right, what is the spec, and then put it in the alerting system, and now almost every piece of gear out there is alerting, like, well, this is not good.
Yeah, maybe it's better not to know. It's one of those scenarios.
We vented one that sits out in a neighborhood where it's a low pole, right? It's a very wealthy neighborhood. They got 35-acre properties, and most of the homes are about $7 million each, and they wanted better internet. So the rules were you got to put a low pole on the ground. You got to camouflage it so we can't see it. So the enclosure box is sitting about 6 inches off the ground. I learned pretty quickly that cows and barbed wire does nothing for a cow. If a cow wants to eat the grass on the inside of the barbed wire, it just goes right through it. So that wrecked one of our radios. So we ended up putting a bunch of, I then learned how to put up the stuff that's electrified, right. Electric fence basically around there. But we vented that enclosure. And now when you get a windstorm in the wintertime, it takes that kind of, they call it surface hoar, that real fine kind of icy granular, and it blows it right in the vents and it shorts out the electrical equipment in there. So we end up spending more time out there in the winter replacing gear on windy days because it just blows that stuff in. So,
damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, because that's always the problem with my barn up in Colorado, is it's, you know, anytime there's always snow going halfway into the barn because, you know, there aren't any weather seals or anything in there. So it's like, yep, know that one.
Well, what do? You can't positively pressurize the thing, because if it's snowing, you'd just be pulling that in to push it out at the bottom. I guess, what do you just make it seal itself in the winter?
Yeah, we have to remember to go do a truck roll towards the end of October and just go put tape over the inside of the vents. And then come April, set ourselves a reminder to go out there and pull the tape off the vents.
Well, I guess if you've got the temperature alerting in there, you'd have that one scream at you at some point. You'd remember to go take it off. It's not going to remind you to put it on, though.
No. No, usually when we have an outage and there's a blizzard, that's what reminds us.
Yeah, I'm always like so torn about active cooling in all this stuff, because it's like one more thing I have to manage. One more thing that I 100% know is going to fail, and it's going to fail at the most inopportune time. And I just hate jacking with that stuff. I mean, it's obviously a necessary evil, especially when you're getting to, like, you know, core equipment where you got to make sure this stuff stays up and stays alive. So I totally understand that. It's just I always try and fudge it around the periphery wherever I can, and I haven't been bitten too bad, but yeah, I've seen it not work out too great. Yeah, the best solution I ever saw was that one where we just kind of parasitically stole AC out of somebody's house to feed into the box. But I don't know that there's too many people, like, at an actual house, like you're saying, micro pops that are going to let you know, cut a hole and steal their air conditioning. It's probably not something they're going to do, but yeah.
Yeah, I was browsing the IO Boxes website today, and they make some nice kind of smaller enclosures that have an air conditioning unit built into them that we may start deploying in the future. But the MicroPop model is not sustainable, and it's a pain in the butt for a variety of other reasons. So I'm trying to avoid more of those.
I wonder if anybody does like a Peltier-based cooling system. And would those kind of last you longer than, say, a standard like air conditioning unit?
You know, when I actually went to the DDB website earlier today to look at the AC unit that I'd been using in the past, they had some Peltiers that they offer for their equipment or for their enclosures now. So, I've seen them, and I've just never seen one in production. But then again, I haven't been doing that kind of stuff now for 2 years or so.
I've never actually looked for it. I mean, from what I understand, it's like a brick of what looks like aluminum. You run electricity through it. One side gets hot, one side gets cold. And you can kind of utilize that to your advantage to cool and or heat something depending on which direction you're going. Like you said, I haven't really looked for it maybe. So I'm assuming some people are using it in production. And since there's like no moving parts, theoretically, and it doesn't have like, there's no refrigerant in it or anything, right? So you're not going to break a hose and there's no mechanical parts to it other than you've got to have a fan to move air around, right? So ultimately those things are going to fail, but probably I bet the meantime between failure on that is a lot longer than just a standard air conditioning setup. So maybe you get a little bit more life out of that.
Can you spin it around in the winter time so that then the hot part is on the inside?
I think
and
you can reverse the electricity.
You just reverse the polarity.
Okay.
Yeah, and then it switches which side is hot and which side's cold.
They're very interesting devices. I had some friends that did some technical papers on them in college, and they had an interesting little, for thermodynamics, they had an interesting little write-up on it. Of course, then they're just, that big, inch-by-inch squares. But, they're really interesting because you can actually use them to generate electricity if you have a hot side on one side and a cold side on the other. You can either use them for energy or for electricity generation, or if they're, depending on which polarity they are, you can either make some, one side hot and one side cold, and or the other side cold and the other side hot. So they're interesting little things, but I think the big thing is they're all DC for the most part, so they're not AC power. They're all set up for DC plants.
Perfect in most remote deployments, though.
I'm curious. I'm going to make myself a note to see if they have any Peltiers kind of. They are becoming, I think, more commercially viable. There's got to be something that you could retrofit onto a box if there's not already ones. You said there's some shipping. Well,
for the DDB stuff, it was always it's basically just a hang-on unit. You drill your holes in your it gives you a template, and you drill your holes in your box, and you just literally hang the AC unit under. So I wonder if those Peltiers are the same type of setup where it's not actually built onto the door or the side of the box. It's something you add, and you can pretty much add it to anything.
I've got a spot where if I had a couple of them that had like a duct on it, that'd be pretty cool, because then I could just attach it to the side of a switch on the inlet fan and just let it put some cold air in there, because I've got some like mechanical rooms that are, man, right now they're getting pretty darn toasty because they also have like the tankless water heaters like on one wall, so it kind of gets toasty in there in the summer. They don't really have any, I think there's some ventilation but not really any air conditioning in there, so maybe if I could shoot just a little bit of cold air right in the intake, that would help things out. Sensing a project ahead of me.
Right.
Yeah, if it's not something related to heat, it's something related to for us, it's a condo owner moved a bunch of their furniture into an IDF closet, and in the process, Jack.
Lost you there for just a second. But
yeah, sorry, the dog's barking, let me go take care of it.
Yeah, no worries. I was thinking, it's heat's the only thing we have to worry about down here. Well, I say that, but we had the snowpocalypse, and that was pretty dramatic for us this year. Does it actually get so cold inside your enclosures, Chad, that you actually have problems with with cold, or is it really just whenever your snow gets sucked in?
No, it does. Our outdoor enclosures, we lose batteries almost every year. The batteries will freeze solid. And so we now are in the process. We run around every spring and put a battery tester on everything. And we'll, it looks like we're losing about four or five batteries or UPS systems every winter, because it'll get to 20 below here for a couple days. We'll get those just Arctic cold spells that come down from Canada, and it freezes the batteries solid that are outside.
How much runtime are you, how much runtime are you looking for on your UPSs?
Normally we're about 12 to 18 hours on our UPSs for our micro pops.
Oh, wow, that's a lot.
And then 24 hours on our towers. And most of the gear is small. Like it's hex POEs that are doing the heavy lifting out there. So it doesn't take much, but you got a couple, 9 amp hour batteries strung together, and a couple of those will freeze in the string. You don't really realize it till you get a quick power outage in the summertime and the site didn't stay up, and you go out there and see that one of the batteries has got, 4 volts on it. Mm.
There's a couple of spots where I want some power backup, but I don't necessarily, here's again my laziness. I hate putting out UPSs because, inevitably they're going to fail. That's going to cause me heartache. I'm going to have to go and jack with it. What I wish I could have is like a little super capacitor that would just hold for 5 minutes. That's literally all I really wanted to do. Really just to bypass brownouts for the most part, right? With some surge suppression. I would love that, because even if the UPS doesn't fail, you'll run into where the UPS will, it'll exhaust all of its power. It'll shut down. Well, when the power utility comes back on, the UPS won't come back on. Right. Or it's just something annoying like that. I just want something that's basically as dumb as possible that can get me 5 minutes. I would love something that would do that.
We had, when I was back working in the TV industry, a lot of our big studios would have these, I forget what they call them now, but it was like a centrifugal UPS, where it was just a big spinning, right wheel. When it would lose line power, that thing was so heavy that it would take it a while to slow down, and that whole time it was still providing power to the building. And those things are pretty slick. A small version of that.
Flywheel based generator.
Yeah.
Those are pretty cool.
Yeah, those are a lot bigger than what I'm looking to do. I'm looking for something really small. Really compact. I saw I can't remember where it was, but I remember reading about a data center that was using one of those, and they had it mounted horizontally, and half of it spun outside of the building. And what they were doing is they were using it as a heat exchanger as well. So it was like absorbing ambient heat from inside the building, and then when it would go outside in the winter, right, it would like super cool. I guess it was a cold environment they were in. It was super cool the outside down, and then it would come back around. So they were using it kind of double duty, which I thought was clever. Yeah. All right. Do you guys have anything else to say about hot stuff or enclosures?
No, I guess you just deal with it and wait for it to get cool again.
Wait for it to blow up.
Texas, it doesn't happen.
Yeah. And it's apparently just humidity's part of my life now. It's great for my skin. It's bad for everything else. I went and played pickleball on Saturday, and it was so humid. I sweat bad as it is, but I was dripping. When I was playing, my shoes, it sounded like I had walked in the creek. They were like squishing, and there was so much sweat in them that it was running out the sides, and I was leaving footprints everywhere I was going.
Ooh.
Yeah, dude, it's disgusting. It is like so swampy here right now. I don't even want to think about it. I think we mentioned, I've seen a lot of back and forth on Terragraph, I think, on the Slack here recently. And Chad, I think this is you that's talking about the Siklu Terragraph stuff. And I saw actually a little video, just kind of a teaser for, I guess, everybody. We'll let the cat out of the bag. Chad's going to be doing a little demo on some Siklu Terragraph stuff here coming up. But you said you had a preview on here. What did you have in mind?
Well, I could preview what's coming. We've got a site that's right now got 7 60 gigahertz multipoint radios on it that are serving a bunch of clients in about a 360 degree pattern. We've got a bunch of self interference that we've been dealing with. There's some other kind of local interference around there. And so we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for TerraGraph to come out because it looks on paper like it's going to solve some of those problems. And we're normally a Cambium shop. Most of our 5 gig stuff is EPMP. And so I was waiting on Cambiums. Looked at what they had that came out, and it didn't really fit what we wanted. And it's, I look at this stuff as I really just want a layer two bridge because it's backhaul equipment. Mm. And Siklu has got, they kind of hit the nail on the head with what we were looking for in terms of that kind of functionality. And so the gear arrived 2 days ago. I was like a kid in a candy store with three big Siklu boxes sitting on my front porch. They're a lot smaller, a lot lighter than I thought this stuff was going to be. Like it, you know, picture that old school Folgers kind of round coffee can. That's about the size of this AP, weighs about 10 pounds. So we're getting ready to configure those and we'll be putting them up on a site that's going to take down all of these multipoints that we've got up. And I've got a mix of QuickBit. I've got MikroTik up there. We've got a Ubiquiti up there, and so all that stuff's going to come down and get, hopefully, if this stuff works, replaced with a single TerraGraph kit and about a dozen terminal units out there to service these. And we use them to feed buildings and blocks of buildings. So an MDU will get a receiver on it. We'll put it on the roof of a building across the street, and then we run one of those MikroTik NetPower 7s. You know, it's that G-Pen type switch that will take a 10 gig SFP in, and then we can run copper to a handful of businesses that are underneath that roof line and hand off internet to them that way. And so it, for us, it's perfect. We don't have the ability to run fiber. There aren't phone poles in our downtown core. You know, it's the classic kind of small America. You got four or five blocks in each direction downtown. You got buildings that are 4 to 5 stories that are perfect for rooftop deployments. It just doesn't work with fiber, but we're hoping that the Siklu TerraGraph stuff is gonna get rid of all the woes we've got with the MikroTik stuff and the self interference and give us some increased bandwidth to these little customers.
So when you're talking about coffee can shaped, is this like 360 degree coverage or is it just like directional?
No, it's 360. They've got four 90 degree kind of patch antennas inside of it. So it's four separate radios in the AP. You can configure them to be all one channel. You can configure them to be four different channels. You can do ABAB. They're synchronized. And then it fits. It's got like a little pole mount on the side of it. And you can mount it either on top of a pole and you get 360 degrees, or you can kind of mount it with on the side of a pole and then it cuts off a, you know, 20 or 30 degree arc, depending upon how big the pole is that you're mounting it to. But yeah, they're designed to be a 360.
So I guess you'd probably mount it on top of a pole and watch you like on the side of a building or something where you were going to lose a little bit anyway. So
yeah, we've got where we're putting it is there's a little like, you know, elevator shack on top of a building. And then we've got some poles mounted to the side of that stick up over the roof line. So we'll get a true 360 degree deployment if we stick this up at the very top of the pole there.
Very nice. And so it sounds like you're really using it as a backhaul.
Yeah, that is absolutely how we look at 60 gig is almost all of our backhaul in our downtown area is 60 gig with a little bit of 80, 70 and 80 gig mixed in where we can't do 60. If we need a lot of bandwidth, we've got some 10 gig, 80 gig links that then provide access to these 60 gig links.
So, I mean, that's exactly how I see most people using 60 gig right now is high bandwidth backhaul, shortish distance runs and stuff like that. So would you see this as that kind of thought process, that build, but all grown up?
Yeah, Siklu and the other guys that are deploying these things are selling them as, well, this is the fiber to the home or the fiber to the premise replacement. And and all of their marketing material is showing these things up on customer roofs. I've got a heartache of putting a $1,700 radio on some guy's private dwelling, right, to then feed it to a handful of homes around it. He sells his home or whatever. There's a number of reasons why not to do that. Right. So we look at it as a short run fiber replacement in a kind of a business district or a real condensed commercial area where we've got true roof rights. We've got legal access to be up there, 24 hour access to these roofs to fix this stuff. It's not on private dwellings. And it works real well for that. It's expensive to directional bore in a downtown neighborhood, especially these older buildings like ours, where now you got to go through foundations that are 150 years old in some cases and super thick, and the building owners don't want people drilling through their stuff to bring new utilities in. So this was a real easy sell for us when we went to these buildings. Say, look, I'm going to put a very small footprint on your roof with a non-pen mount, and we're going to ride some existing conduit down to your telco closet, and we're done. And $500 later, I got a building online that I can light up almost the same day sometimes that they call us and want service and put a switch up there, and now I've got the whole block.
Yeah, in our downtown areas, I think it's probably all across the U.S. It's the revitalization of downtown, right? There's a lot of redevelopment projects, and so a lot of utilities have been or utility poles have been removed, right? A lot of that stuff's moved underground, and if you weren't lucky enough to be there while the sidewalks were open, you're kind of SOL, because you were saying it's expensive to do that, but not only is it expensive in money, it's expensive in time. It takes freaking forever to get those utilities directional board through there. And then even then, there's all those other services that are layered on top of there. Like down in our downtown, we have plenty of electrical crisscrossing. Some of it's really old, plenty of gas lines that are moving through there, water mains. And so it's precarious. And even then, some of the guys that do like really good at directional boring and stuff like that, they won't do work in downtown. They're like, no, we have plenty of work everywhere else. And, it's too much liability. It's too much of a pain in the ass. Even though we're going to charge you through the nose, we still don't want to do it. So it could be difficult in that respect as well. Well, down here, it's like our best guys, the university keeps them busy all the time. And they're like, unless you got some monster project, we're not going to do it. And then, it's like, and we have so much work that we're turning away. We're not going to do that. We're going to do that stuff. So it could be difficult on multiple levels.
Yeah. And a lot of municipalities are getting irritated with all the boring. And so now you can't just patch a small section. You got to pull out an entire section of sidewalk or alleyway and repave that. And so it just gets more and more expensive because they're tired of all these holes everywhere.
Mm. We've seen. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's also been kind of what we've been seeing in our main use for 60 gig is we're doing MDU hopping with it. And right now we're still in the 1 gig because very few of our MDUs are multi-gig customers currently. So, but yeah, that's exactly, it's like, right before we got on this chat, it was a case of I was setting up some Cube 60s for a 250-meter MDU hop, and it's quick, it's easy. My guys had it done in like 30 minutes, and they're like, wow, that was stupid easy when you buy the prepared kits. And I was like, exactly, that's why we've been going to them.
Even like the garden level apartments where you got six or a dozen buildings that are all spread out and each one's got its own kind of telco closet, you put up some of those Cube 60s or little 60 gig point-to-point stuff to hop in a ring around the whole complex, and now you've got everything without ever putting a shovel in the ground.
Yeah. And to your point with those pre-configured radios, I've dealt with a lot of people from a lot of different industries for a long time. So inadvertently, I'll get somebody who'll call me like, hey, I need to do here to here. I got to get this camera and this other thing. I got to get them on net. And, it's got to be a decent bandwidth. What do I do? I was like, just order this, plug it in. And they're like, how do I configure it? You don't have to. You just point them at each other and it's going to work. And so that's really nice to be able to just give people the easy button sometimes on those things.
Yeah, we use them a lot in the festival world too, where you're setting up these temporary music festivals and parks or whatnot, and you've got to get gigabit now, as weird as it seems, to all over these festival sites, and you can't bury stuff because we do one in Golden Gate Park each year in San Francisco, and you can't put a shovel in the ground there ever. So you end up putting a ton of 60 gig up on little poles. And when you get these kind of beam forming guys, the pole can still kind of sway back and forth in the wind, and the beam forming just works. And you're getting gigabit around these sites. They are so simple now at short range, a couple hundred meters to get high speeds.
Yeah. But like when I was doing stuff with the Grizzlies, there was always frequency contention out there because one is the stadium is using 5 gigahertz. I basically eliminated all 2 gigahertz stuff in there. You can't get 20,000 people in a stadium all into it. It's just that's not it's not manageable, but whenever you'd have like a show roll in or like the WWE or something like that, all of their equipment was running like in 5 gig range, you know, or it might be in the 240. So it's, if you're trying to like light up a little kiosk somewhere where you can't run a cable, it's like 60 gig would have been perfect. I mean, we didn't have it back then, but that would have been ideal to be able to, you know, not interfere with any of the weird stuff going on. It's just here, take this, be happy.
Yeah, everyone just brings in 5 gig with no thought about the interference it's going to have. And a lot of the lighting stuff runs on 5 gig, stuff that's not even internet related, just various IP traffic all runs on 5 gig. And they wonder, well, why does this suck when I set it up here?
Yeah, that's a nightmare. But
I've been saying we're our own worst interferer. You know, I'll, you know, that 60 gig link I put up today, it actually replaced a 5 gig link. And when you scanned on that Air Max radio, it was just, you know, I was like, oh, those are all our SSIDs on our 5 gigs. We're our own worst interferer. And, you know, it also doesn't help that where we really should have been using more directional 5 gig setups, we weren't. So, you know, it just amplifies the problem.
We had here a funny story. We had a lost a 5 gig Ubiquiti AP over the winter, and it was a point in the time where we couldn't climb the tower due to storms. And we had a couple important customers on it, and there's another WISP on that tower. We're very friendly with them. We buy backhaul from them. And so I asked them, hey, you got Ubiquiti gear. Can you put an SSID that matches ours on it so I don't have to truck roll, and I can get these guys onto your network, you know, for a week until I can climb up there? Sure, no problem. They had an unused radio. They put our SSID and password on it. Customers got it back online. We ended up fixing ours, and then for months, we're chasing problem after problem after problem with all these sites. And I thought someone was logging in and doing DDoS attacks on us, and I could not figure out why our customers would not stay online. Every time I'd reboot our AP, they'd come on for a few minutes, and they'd disappear. And finally, I'm out at a customer site troubleshooting this months later, and I'm looking at the Air Max. I'm like, wait a minute. I see my SSID up there twice on two different frequencies. The ISP that had helped us out never went back in. He just forgot to shut that down. And so two of us were transmitting the same SSID and password for months. And so my radios were just hopping between the two of them and interfering with each other. I called him up and he went, oh, yeah, let me take care of that. Problem went away.
I hate that kind of problem. So hard to pin down.
Yeah.
You think it's something extremely complex, like you got a hacker on the network? No, it's just something simple, like you left an SSID on that routes to nowhere.
Man, that makes me think of we got a new guy at work, and so we have kind of our own Tiger Lab, you know, that we can put our own stuff in. And he's like a DevOps guy, and so he starts, you know, he's like looking at the services that are available, and you know, he's like, well, you know, we can have SSH open to the internet on this thing, and we'll just put in fail demand, you know, stuff like that. And so it got into this debate of, you know, at what point does it make sense to leave that stuff open to the internet, you know, with kind of a fail demand, as in somebody tries to brute force it, and then it'll just, you know, put a firewall rule in place to block them, versus making sure that, you know, if the service doesn't need to be available on the internet, it's not. And I'm of the camp of, if nobody needs to log into it, it shouldn't exist, right? Just lower your attack surface as much as possible. And also, we've seen exploits just in protocols themselves, you know? Yeah. So just because, you know, your brute force doesn't work doesn't mean eventually that protocol, you know, that implementation of SSH or HTTPS or whatever it is, isn't going to get a vulnerability and have people have the access to get in there. Which camp do you guys float in? Just curious.
You know, I'm really of the if it doesn't need to be up, it doesn't need to be up. And I guess that was just kind of the old school. You know, you start looking around at public safety networks, half that stuff's air gapped, just completely air gapped. And so it's like, there's, you know, if anything, it's a non-routable computer has a window in to where you can run commands on a secondary interface. It's like, there's just so little, you know, they try so hard to keep that as you know, general public doesn't need to know about this or have access to it through the internet. So we're not going to let, and we're just not going to set up it, you know, set up for it to respond.
And we don't have anything. It's very rare something's open to the outside world. Like every now and then, we've been working with Prasim on some issues, and they need to SSH in. So we'll open up an SSH in a window for them, but we require their IP addresses that they're coming through. So we'll put them into a, you know, an address list. So, and then it shuts down the moment they've said, okay, we're good. I turn that service back off. Everything else, you have to VPN into one of our VPN concentrators to get on the network. Nothing else is open. And then internally, I do the same thing. We made sure very early on that any customer IP has no access to anything management related so that they can't port scan or get no way for them to get on our network. Mm. It's just impossible.
Well, see, we're network guys, right? So I'm thinking maybe that I think that's probably a very network guy way of thinking. This guy had always been like a systems guy, you know, so maybe that's why his brain was sort of over at that area. And I think it makes sense to, you know, belt and suspenders, those scenarios, right? Like if it does need to be open, well, then, yeah, put something like fail to ban, you know, do everything you can to try and lower your attack surface. But, yeah, he just, I don't know. It was funny because he didn't see, for whatever reason, he didn't fundamentally see it as a problem. He's like, no, I totally got it protected. But it's like, I've screwed up stuff accidentally so many times and accidentally opened access to things. It's like, no, if I don't even... I don't even want to open the opportunity for me to screw something up because odds are I'll do it. So why not just keep it close? That does definitely make sense to me. But yeah, it was curious to me because I don't know, my brain did not work in that way. I was like, how would you even think that's okay? I mean, I get it, but it freaks me out. I don't want to, why would you want to open that up? And just, but you know what, also think about like cloud services, you know, all this ephemeral stuff that just lives on somebody else's site somewhere. You got to protect this stuff somehow. Maybe it's like you start making mental shifts when you start looking at the world through that lens. I don't.
Yeah, but you feel that way because you've been up at 3 o'clock in the morning fixing something that got hacked or broken because someone got into it. He may not have been there yet, and the moment he has to get up and spend an entire early morning fixing something, he's going to change his tune. And we used to use a ton of cloud service stuff. And we learned after a few of them got compromised that we brought a lot of it in-house and is on-premise stuff now because we can protect it better than I can protect some of the cloud stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, then I think it's also a case of if you're not, you know, for me, it's like I don't do a lot of protection on the inside of my network. So... But I think, some distributions and server distributions and whatnot are a little bit better about not opening up everything just because you installed it than others. But, it's like, it's very careful. Hey, don't let this go out on the internet and create that pinhole that something can come back in unwanted.
Mm. For sure.
We switched our billing system not too long ago, and it has Radius built in, and so that we didn't know there was a test account that just came default on the billing system with a Radius account of test for username and password, and it was tied into our Radius server, and it opened up all of our customer MikroTik routers where you could log in with test, and it was that way for about 2 days until we caught it. And the reason we caught it was about 80% of our customer routers, our MikroTik routers, got hacked with the test account. These are old. They were ones that were on an old script that didn't have those services turned off. And suddenly these guys are calling us saying, hey, I'm losing services. And we logged in and they had created all sorts of private accounts for them. And really we're using more as a proxy, but it took less than a day for those routers to get found and hacked with just by exposing a Radius credential. So they're out there trying constantly. Hmm.
A desperate cat and mouse game. Yeah, that's like, yeah. I don't know if you guys have followed up on the Colonial Pipeline stuff, you know, that ransomware that hit the pipeline that controlled like most of the East Coast distribution of gas and stuff like that. I noticed some news article that was saying that the FBI has like recovered most of the ransom money that they actually paid out to those guys. Yeah. So somehow they got a hold of their Bitcoin wallet key, the FBI did. I have no idea how that's possible, but I think that's quite fascinating that most of the money has been recovered at this point. So That's very interesting.
Might be a little bit of a deterrent for those.
Yeah,
guys.
Maybe that stuff's not quite as anonymous as we once thought it was.
Yeah.
Huh. Who knows? So I don't know. Does that signal the end of these guys using Bitcoin as much for their ransom attacks? I mean, I don't know what they would pivot to, but they were saying that they can actually track down the Bitcoin stuff significantly faster than they could the old way of like paying ransom through banks, because they have to like submit all this legal paperwork to banks, and it can take like years before each bank that they hop through to actually release the information, the records to them. And then they can take that and then contact the next one. And then so you might actually be better off doing it the good old fashioned way, which I thought was.
Yeah, it'll go back to those old, remember those metal briefcases that you would fill with cash and handcuff them to some guy's wrist? And that's how you deliver the ransom money now.
I was going to say, you do it in cash and then you have a good money launderer.
Yep.
Yeah, with those volumes of cash, I'm pretty sure you could probably find something. You open your El Pollo Loco or whatever.
Right. Find the Nigerian prince. He's still looking to help you out.
Mm. Always looking, always eager to assist everyone.
Yes.
Goodness. Well, do you guys have anything new or interesting you're working on? I've actually, now that I say that, I'm just going to mention it here because I'm going to dig more into it in the next week or two. But have you guys ever heard of an open source project called Batfish?
No.
Sounds familiar.
I hadn't heard about them until just recently. I started kind of looking into them. And they only work with certain vendors' products. And what it does is you take your configurations, right? So it's really like Cisco, Juniper, Arista, I think Palo Alto. There's a couple others. I think you can put your AWS stuff in there and some others. Anyway, you take your configurations, you put it on a server, and you let Batfish like crawl through these things. And then you can use it for all sorts of things. Like one of the things I saw them, like the primary use case that like is interesting to me, is that you can do testing, like configuration change testing inside of this without having to build like a big demo environment and all this stuff. It ingests the configurations. You could say, hey, see if this subnet is allowed access. Or rather, you put like a before condition and after condition. You say, I want to make sure that, you know, 192.168.0.1 can get all the way through these five routers and hop over here, right? Whether it be routing or ACL changes, it's like, I want to be able to do that. So here's before I make the change and here's after the change, right? So before the change, it should fail, shouldn't be able to work. After the change, it should work. So those are my test conditions. And then I feed it in the configuration changes I plan to make on all the pieces of equipment, and then it will ingest that. It'll check the precondition, and it'll check the post condition, and it'll tell you if it passes or fails. And if it, you know, for whatever reason it sees that it's going to fail, it'll tell you specifically on what devices the reasons it changed. So you can also do changes like, I want this network absolutely secured, and so that can be part of one of the test procedures. And so even if that's not something you were touching or even thinking about, whenever it's running through those tests, it can say, oh, you inadvertently opened up access to this one subnet. Are you sure that's what you wanted to do? And the really cool part for me is that you can integrate it into your pipelines. So you can have it like somebody goes into your ITSM system and they say, hey, I want to make a firewall change. And then it will automatically call the Batfish system. It'll run it through all of these changes to see if there was any adverse errors. It'll come back and say, yep, that's clean. It looked okay. It'll put a ticket in the system, reach out to your automation system, automatically make the change, reach back to your ticket system and say, hey, everything's complete. Like, to me, that is akin to magic. I am really curious to see how this, obviously it doesn't support like MicroTik and stuff. These guys are chasing like, you know, big financial institutions and, you know, guys that like absolutely can't have any downtime, right? That's the whole point of this stuff. One is like compliance, to make sure you're, you know, adhering to your compliance or whatever, but really to prevent downtime. You could basically say as one of the checks, am I going to have any disruptive failures due to these changes or whatever it happens to be? So I thought that was pretty insane to think about, that there would be like a system that would emulate and build all this. And I also saw that it can build like maps of your network in dot format. I've never seen that before, but it can spit it out so that it will, you can like ingest it in other systems that will auto build a map for you. So instead of having to crawl your network, I mean, that's kind of the interesting part of this, is it's never touching your live equipment. It's just looking at backups of your devices. So it can't break anything. It can just test and simulate. So I'm going to play with that. They have an open source version. They have an enterprise version. So I'm going to play with their enterprise version, I think, because that's going to have all the cool bells and whistles and features. I'm going to see if I can get some demos moving with that. But the idea of that is pretty fascinating. I wonder, it is open source, so if somebody was so inclined, they could add the MikroTik parsers. Because really what it does is it parses it in a vendor agnostic method, right? So if it's like Cisco, it'll ingest it and put it in this vendor agnostic format. If it's Juniper, it does the exact same thing, right? So ultimately, they all look the same to the Batfish system. So all you'd have to do is have somebody write the same thing for MikroTik so that it would ingest it in the same way. And then you could have it, you know, pretest configuration changes that you want to do on your network. You could say, hey, I want to get, you know, I want to roll from bridge to routed or something akin to that. This site, here's the changes I plan on making. What's it going to do? And it could say, hey, you're going to break everything with this. Oh, my bad. Let me fix that. Oh, now you're going to break everything with this. Oh, my bad. Let me fix it. You know, so you could actually get it in place without having to. One of the use cases I was seeing was Texas A&M right here. They actually did a thing, and they have over 4,300 network elements that they maintain manually. And this system, it's like, can you imagine? I'm gonna move a VLAN, or I'm gonna make a change on this one piece of equipment over here. How do I test and make sure that's not gonna break all other, you know, 4,000 other devices? That's just, that's mind blowing to think humans can be able to maintain all that. So if you had a system that could magically do all that, I'm sure it's not perfect. I'm sure I'm gonna find holes in it, but it's fascinating. Like, I think it'll be really interesting to see all of those dominoes kind of move on their own. That's a lot of time.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time keeping track of a couple hundred devices. I can't imagine manually keeping track of tens of thousands of devices.
Yeah, it's pretty bonkers. So I'm actually kind of, I'm keen to see this thing move. I want to see it orchestrate some cool stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got, let's see, I've got close to 4,000 standalone MikroTik APs right now. So I'm, you know, and then I recently went down the Ansible rabbit hole, and so, you know, that I'm working on that and just writing different plays and integrating idempotency, and I think, you know, later tonight in our nightly maintenance window, I'm going to try my Ubiquity script at a single site instead of trying to push it across all 280 something head switches. So I don't have one of those situations like I had the other day, because that was no fun. I was in Dallas and I was trying to get home. I had the kids in the back of the truck, and or my manager kept calling me, can you stop this? Can you stop this? I was like, it stopped. It's done. It's done. The play's done. So.
Yeah. It's something I was listening to a presentation today, and one of the takeaways I had is that automation isn't always to be completely hands-off. It's really just trying to cut down your manual effort, right? So if like your normal process takes you 12 manual steps and you can cut it down to 5 manual, you're getting advantages, right? So even if you don't say, hey, go across all 280 switches at once, you know, if you just do it, you know, just a little chunk at a time, to feel safe about it, that's still big advantages from your automation, right? You don't have to.
And you know, it doesn't help. It was my error in judgment that led me to run that, because I was just tired of looking at everything being so far behind on releases and not on like you. I had one switch sitting right next to another, and they're on like wildly different releases. But it was my error in judgment. Because, you know, for one, I'm 1,200 miles away from these switches. So it's not like I can go out and do a truck roll. And, you know, I'd happily go do it, but it's not like I can. I have to get my field techs to go do it. you know, and even then they're still an hour plus away sometimes. Mm. So
such is life. That's why they get paid the big bucks. To handle it.
Yeah, they live on the beach. They all of them live on the beach, and they have a, you know, but they work a lot, and they work long hours, and but they get compensated for it.
That's good. So. Taking care of your people, man. I love to hear that. So what else is new and interesting that you guys got going on?
You know, I had seen the we're kind of interested in the little in the knots, and then when I guess Thrift posted the Bluetooth tags that MikroTix may or may not be pushing through FCC certification right now, I got really interested. I was like, ooh, that's quite interesting there. I wonder what they're going to be priced, because most of the tags I've seen so far are about, you know, if you buy them in bulk, they're $20 to $30 a piece. And by bulk, I mean like you're buying 500 or 600 of them. It's like, I don't need that many of them.
And that's, yeah, because when they announced the knots, I couldn't exactly wrap my head around the use case. And then they were saying, you know, like in the medical field, you could track assets. And now they're talking about, hey, let's release tokens that actually tie right into the system that you would, you know, I guess physically attach that to the, I don't know, whatever it happens to be, like your medical equipment or whatever, so you can watch it moving around.
Yeah, I'm curious if there's going to be some sort of, you know, maybe they'll have a Dude integration to where you can
you bite your
run,
tongue.
Run that. You know, if there's going to be some software that's, you know, that lets you track all that stuff. Of like, because that's the big thing. It's like, you know, unless you're adding something custom or just, you know, in your NMS saying, oh, yes, I just saw this device and that's it. That's, you know, you're running into a lot of unanswered questions.
What is it? I mean, it runs some protocols like Mosquito or something, right? To where I guess you could potentially connect to it, but you'd like a more holistic approach, some kind of software package?
Well, or, you know, just some way to generally, you know, some kind of software package, even if it's not MikroTik, that'd be great. Just so you can say, oh, look, yeah, I can hand this off to a customer and say, look, here's how you can track the stuff. You know, you have a portal into the service. Here's how you can track it. You know, just like we do with cameras, you have a computer that sits there and has all of the camera views, and you can access the NVR and everything on there, you know, something similar. Just so they can do it, because, you know, we're ISP second, MSP first, but we're very limited on MSP stuff. We mainly do video, voice, and network. So,
And I'm unfamiliar with these technologies. Is it like you would deploy a trio of these knots and you'd be able to triangulate the position of these tokens? Or, I mean, how many of those things?
Theoretically, you could do that, but I think the general idea is just, you know, the RF propagation characteristics are so low that it's like, oh, I hear this device. He must be within X amount of feet of me. You know, it's just something that simple. Or, you know, if you hear, you know, if you have two of them that say, oh, we both hear this device. He must be, you know, physically between us somewhere. And so depending on how far you space them, you can, you know, best guess it with, you know, it's not exact location. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, if you look at, I think the Apple tags that just came out, they're not, they don't give you a GPS location. They get you within, they're set up to get you within audible range, and then you can make the tag play noise. Mm. So you can track it down.
Mm. So you'd put, I guess like in a, you know, like their medical tracking demo, you'd put one like near every egress point and then sporadically in the building, I guess, so you could at least see if it's trying to walk out the door.
Well, you know, what we looked at doing was like, you know, for our MBUs, or the hotels, the valet carts, the luggage carts. Mm. But you put one on you put a tag on your luggage cart, and then you put a knot at, you know, by the elevator in each floor, and then, you know, maybe depending on how long your hallways are through the hallway, and then you can say, oh, this is, you know, over by this riser somewhere. This is in a room by this riser. You know, something real, you know, real simple. It doesn't give you an exact answer of where it is, but it gives you a general idea of where it is. You know, it hasn't left the property, and you know it's just in some unit.
Yeah, especially if you can make it play an audible tone, that would be nice. You walk up generally where it's supposed to be. If you don't see it, you just make it start making racket so they'll drag it out into the hall. That makes sense.
We had a lot of before I got there, they were discovering default forward feature, and they had people who would, in the middle of the night from, you know, the other side of the building, just start blasting music through a Sonos or a Chromecast. So, you know, you say that, it's like, oh, that brings up stories.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's a problem we're tracking down right now. We provide service to a bar, and there's a couple different SSIDs. One is for their POS system, one is for staff, and one is a public Wi-Fi. And it's all managed through a Meraki system, and the public Wi-Fi has got to log in, and they, you know, captures email. It's got a captive portal on it. It's all VLAN apart. Everything's totally separate, except Sonos apparently has some sort of layer 2 broadcast protocol where if you get on the public Wi-Fi, it will find the Sonos bridges that are on the staff VLAN, and you can control them from the Sonos app on your phone, even though you're on a different layer 7, that it's got some sort of broadcast protocol that just blows right through the firewall.
Amazing.
And works on layer 2. So now I got to figure out how to stop that from happening, because people keep changing their music in the bar. That's pissing off the manager.
Amazing. Love it.
Well, I know some Sonoses, and there's a hub you can get, and we've actually recommended this to a couple of customers because they have, you know, they want 802.11b available or else they don't work right, and we turn 802.11b off. And there's a hub you can buy, which instead of talking to your access point, everything will use a, you know, more of a Bluetooth protocol instead of a Wi-Fi protocol to the hub, and then the hub can either wire in or go wirelessly into your system. And yeah, I could see that, if especially if you weren't using some of that stuff, it could be a real problem.
Luckily, most beer drinking bar patrons aren't randomly launching their Sonos app and seeing what it does, but there's enough that it seems to be an issue once the word gets out.
Hey, change the music here.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, guys. Well, we are at about an hour and 20. You ready to stick a fork in it?
Let's do it.
All right. So I'll start reverse order. We got Chad Walks. If people were interested in getting a hold of you out on the internet, the big bad internet, how would you have them do that? Other than opening their Sonos app and then sending something over to you.
Yeah, send me a voice tune that way. Yeah, you can either find me on the Brothers Whip Slack channel, or you can get me at chat@auwireless.net.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Zapalak, how would you have folks get a hold of you?
You know, there's always Brothers Wisp, and then I guess I've got this great blog website that I run, which is wireless communications technology. So that's wirelesscomtech.com, and, you know, the com and communications is with two M's. So you can always get a hold of me there.
Excellent. And we will definitely have a link to your EdgeSwitch stuff in there so people will be able to find you. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm Greg at gregsoul.com, where I regularly blog. Again, also, if you guys have any questions or comments for the podcast, you can email me or contact us at the Brothers Wisp. It all goes to the same place. Having said that, to get a hold of me, probably the easiest way is via the Patreon only Slack. You go to patreon.com/thebrotherswisp, throw us a few ducats, and you get access to this fantastic, magical, Willy Wonka world that is the Little Brothers with Slack. There's a lot of great communication in there, and there's actually an inspiring, encouraging post that caught on fire the other day. I think Chad actually started it, so hopefully we'll see some great new things coming. Already a couple of new faces, and hopefully we can have some more interesting stuff coming your way. Thank you guys so much for doing this stuff on the spur. Chad, Colin, I kind of combined your names there. Sure appreciate you guys. Questions, comments, keep them coming, and nothing else. Thank you guys. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
All right. I'm going to hit stop on all this stuff. I leave this in on purpose, me clicking stop. And Tommy said that he hates it, which makes me want to leave.